Hello, this is Homicide Solutions, and we are in March 2010. And that means we are at the March 2010 issue, because there is nothing else to do right now, nothing better to do. So let's match the month with the issue. Now, this month we are going to talk about setting marketing budget for optimized client acquisition. Do you know that more people are allergic to cow's milk than any other food? The reason why I mention this hair-raisingly, mind you, not my hair, yours, hair-raisingly interesting fact is that in many IT companies, executives seem to be more allergic to setting their marketing budgets than anything else. Actually, there's only one topic to which they are more allergic: setting their fees and prices. Therefore, budget setting becomes a guesswork, and very often this guesswork creates pathetically small marketing budgets, which in turn create pathetic bottom lines in the following years. Many small and medium-sized IT companies invest only a mere 1 to 3% of their gross revenues in marketing. Many of them invest less than 1%. Why so little? Hell knows. Most of them can cite their now famous Peter Drucker quotation on marketing even in their sleeps, but in real life they seem to ignore it. You know the quotation I mean, because its purpose is to create a client, the business has two and only two functions: marketing, creating a customer, and innovation, creating a new dimension of performance. Marketing and innovation produce results, all the rest are costs. Yet, most IT businesses shrink their marketing budgets in order to boost their other budgets, to buy more company cars, to buy more technology, more gadgets, and all sorts of useless bits and bobs that may look great on the surface, but contribute precisely dick to their revenue creation process. And it's all because their dumb owners, often to the advice of their tightwad accountants, regard marketing as an expense that must be reduced or, if it is all possible, completely eliminated. Sadly, so many accountants advise their business owner clients to reduce overhead costs, and since many accountants don't understand business beyond number crunching, they believe they do business owners a favor by advising them to reduce everything to the bare minimum. And, of course, that includes marketing. Hey, we don't make money, but we don't spend money either. This reminds me of former US President Jimmy Carter's period in the White House. He didn't do anything, so he didn't make mistakes. Hey, that's good. I've met business owners who, to their accountant's advice, terminated marketing initiatives that brought in $3 to $8 on each dollar invested. The dumb accountant was so hell-bent on cutting operating costs that he advised the business owner client to forego the potential profits in order to save some money. So, what does it all mean? It means that so many IT businesses spend more money on chasing pathetic suspects than they are willing to invest in attracting self-selected and self-qualified buyers through good marketing systems. Although Ian Gillan sang on Deep Purple's 1984 album Perfect Strangers, "It's not the kill, it's the thrill of the chase." I dare to assume that Ian wasn't involved in prospecting for audience members on a daily basis. So it's easy to enjoy the process one is not forced to do every day. However, most business people can easily imagine their lives without core prospecting grunt work. But if you don't want to do the prospecting slavery, you have to play the prospecting automation game. You have to create the proverbial honeypot that will magnetically attract the right people, and that requires a budget. But the earth-shattering question is, how to set a marketing budget? When it comes to setting marketing budgets, we can split people into two groups. By the way, this idea is nicely outlined in Clark A. Campbell's book, The One-Page Project Manager for IT Projects, to communicate and manage any project with a single sheet of paper. I may be using different words, but it's his idea, basically. Oh, and I think this book should be a mandatory read, should be mandatory reading for every employee in the IT industry who's involved in project work. I totally recommend this book. So again, it's, where is it? Clark A. Campbell, The One-Page Project Manager for IT Projects. Communicate and manage any project with a single sheet of paper. Look it up on Amazon. So there are forward thinkers. These people try to figure out what they can achieve by using their current resources. The achievement remains uncertain, but the resources used to achieve those outcomes are fixed rigid. They're rigidly fixed. It's like a farmer who says that he has only one sack of seed corn and that's all he's willing to plant. He doesn't even seem to care about outcomes, only how much he's willing to put in. So, some virtues of forward thinkers: a can-do attitude, keen on getting started, effective individual contributors, confident in high and have high energy. They are good with headlines. Some of the vices are may paint themselves into a corner by starting things before they are fully thought out. Lots of improvisation and fly by the seat of their pants. Low or no patience for planning. Poor delegators, although sometimes they abdicate. Focus on costs at the expense of value. The question is what we can achieve, something unknown, by using our existing resources. And now there are the backward thinkers. Some virtues of backward thinkers. They are sure the project is well planned and stays on budget. They are good planners. They are good at budgeting for expected ROI. They are not budgeting for costs. They are budgeting for expected outcomes. Good process and system thinkers, good collaborators and real delegators, organized, and as I said, they focus on expected ROI and adjust their budgets accordingly. Some of their vices: slow to begin and may allow some time to slip in the planning stage, often suffer from paralysis of analysis, tend to overplan and miss deadlines. Everything must be perfect before they start. And we haven't even discussed childhood conditioning yet, but not being a psychologist, I shouldn't really go there. But it's important to know, just based on my studies as a kind of amateur psychologist through my readings and the courses I've done, that childhood conditioning has a huge role in that too. But I'm saying this off the record. But now we can see how different people think differently about setting budgets. But first, let's look at some statistics on marketing. These statistics are especially for small and medium-sized organizations, IT companies, and I've collected them from different sources, including the Gartner Group or whatever you know these typical research companies that specialize on researching different industries and producing reams and reams of paper with all sorts of wild and woolly statistics. And while the numbers may deviate from country to country, because some of the stats are from different countries, not all of them are from America, some of them are from Europe, even Australia, but never mind the numbers, never mind the absolute value of the numbers, look at the numbers and their relationships to each other. Okay. So in 2009, only a mere 32.8% of small and medium-sized organizations did any marketing at all. This is a significant increase from the 18.7% in 2002. The other 67.2% used oversight sales forces to hunt for buyers. But that's a bit sad because they don't even realize that hunting for buyers is more expensive, both financially and emotionally, than using good marketing to attract buyers. Contrary to the recommended 5 to 10% in marketing literature that should be set aside for marketing budget, most small and medium enterprises invest only 4% of their current gross revenue into marketing. The top-notch SMEs invest 13-15% of their projected revenues in marketing and grow way higher than 50% annually. Do you see the two types of people in action? Forward thinkers base their marketing decisions on current resources, present. Backward thinkers base their marketing decisions on the company's goals, future. Forward thinkers want to plant as little as possible for cost focus. Backward thinkers want to harvest as much as possible, value focus or outcome result focus. Boston Consulting Group's research between 1980 and 1995 showed that companies that invest differently in marketing grow differently. The companies that reduced marketing during hard times grew by a mere 5% over the next 15 years. The ones that stepped on the marketing accelerator grew by as much as 500% over the next 15 years. Only 19% of the small and medium enterprises invest 5 to 10% of their revenues in marketing. Sadly, another 19% invests nothing at all, not a sausage. 35% of them have no earthly idea how much they spend on marketing. They just spend and see what happens. But, well, without tracking, it's not really investing, is it? It's just really pissing it down the drain. 54% of SMEs use the internet for marketing purposes. 35% uses printed marketing. And 26% uses flyers. I'm not 100% certain, but I have a sneaking suspicion that a large chunk of the printed marketing is some kind of full-colored, self-centered branding document, not properly written, client-focused marketing documents. And here is a good reflection of how SME owners regard marketing. Only 7% of them employ dedicated marketing people. 3.9% employ one person and 0.98% employ two people. Only 33% of them rely 33% of these marketing people rely on their practical experience in their positions. 25% of them participate in professional development programs, while 22% use hope and prayer to get things done. 65% of SMEs fail to offer any kind of professional development to their marketing people. Among all SME marketing people, only 16% attend conferences, seminars, and workshops. 15% subscribe to marketing magazines. 14% subscribe to newsletters. And only 12% read books. Most of them just go to work, go through the daily motions while daydreaming of the upcoming week and booze up and go home. Only 7% of SMEs ever enlist external marketing help and support. Interestingly, large companies have a couple of consultants working on major initiatives actually all the time. For SMEs, using consultants is a waste of money. For large companies, it's a wise investment with excellent return. It seems merely thinking and acting differently creates miracles and different results. An alarmingly high percentage of SMEs are obsessed with the kind of image marketing which is great for large corporations with multi-million dollar marketing budgets, selling commodities to consumers, but it's useless for IT SMEs selling complex high-ticket solutions in the B2B world. Most SMEs invest most of their marketing money in generating new clients, while investing almost nothing in converting first-time clients into repeat clients. So we can easily conclude that most SMEs are cost-obsessed and ROI-ignorant. But let's take a closer look at larger companies' marketing budgets. Microsoft's marketing budget is 21%. Adobe's is 33%. Interestingly, for blockbuster movies, the total budget's 40 to 60% is dedicated to marketing. Well, that's why they are blockbusters, aren't they? And now, let's take a look at some of these large companies' productivity, just to see if the investment is justified. And by productivity, I really mean per person, per employee production, the revenue per employee or profit per employee. And we can do that fairly easily just by dividing some numbers. I believe that revenue per employee or profit per employee is really the only meaningful productivity indicator for a company. Based on data from Google Finance, at 1,080,000, roughly 1,081,000 revenue per employee and 209,000 profit per employee, Google is the best performing high-tech company. 19.3% pre-tax profit. At 664,000 revenue per employee and 194,000 profit per employee, Microsoft is the second best, 29.2% pre-tax profit. And remember, Microsoft's marketing budget is 21% and the return is pretty sweet, I must say. Adobe's 33 budget produces 488,000 revenue per employee and 118 profit per employee. 24.3% pre-tax profit. Brilliant. This is very good. At 413 revenue per employee and 12,000 profit per employee, Sun Microsystems is the bottom of the pile, 2.9 pre-tax profit. Like, in the SME world, for this kind of productivity, the CEO would not only be fired, but would be hanged and quartered and drained and would be forced to eat a sausage. HP at 368,000 revenue per employee and 25,000, almost 26,000 profit per employee is pretty close to the bottom, 7.03 pre-tax profit. But conventional wisdom doesn't measure revenue per employee, it measures gross revenue. So these are the blue-eyed boys of Wall Street because they are producing outstanding gross revenues. The other way Wall Street measures the success of these companies is assets. In assets, HP leads the high-tech world, 109.63 billion. But there are some other points to consider. Yes, Google is the most profitable, but also has the highest cost of doing business. At this point, companies can focus either on reducing costs or increasing profits. I guess Google is more concerned with increasing profits than reducing costs. What we can also see is that Google at 33.51 billion assets and Microsoft 68.85 billion assets are asset-light, knowledge-based companies, while HP at 109.63 billion assets and IBM 101.95 billion in assets are asset-heavy industrial factories. So what comes into the foreground is productivity, producing, and knowledge work is shifted to the background. While not included in the original list, Nintendo with its 1.6 million revenue per employee beats most high-tech companies. For the first quarter in 2009, Nintendo made 993 million in profit with some 3,000 employees. This is about 331,000 in profit per employee. Remember, Google's annual profit per employee is 209,000, some 60% of Nintendo's productivity. Yes, large public companies need to please Wall Street with assets and gross revenue, but for SMEs, the real measure of success is profit per employee. If this number is pretty good, then everything else can be improved. But IT SMEs can't operate as if they were multinational corporations. So they have to set their marketing budgets in such a way that they can make good money and the overhead costs don't kill them. Actually, this seems to be easier for smaller companies due to their lower headcount. It's easier to get high performance out of a few people than out of a crowd. With that in mind, we have to take a look at what we call the economies of scale. In microeconomics, when more units of a product or service can be produced on a larger scale, yet with the same or even less input cost, we've achieved economies of scale. The human resources aspect of the economies of scale is when the company can produce more profit without adding additional people. So one person operations production costs are high for the business owners do everything. As owners hire help, they start moving down the economics of scale until an optimum number of employees are reached for optimum production. Hiring more people only increases production costs, thus putting business owners on the diseconomies of scale curve. So in the written version, you can see that little drawing, the economies of scale, that's when the company is understaffed. There are not enough people, so the business owner has to do everything. So because of that, the production cost to render service or deliver the product is high. At the other end, when headcount goes up significantly, we reach diseconomies of scale. The company is overstaffed. There are too many people, so that's why production costs are high. But in the middle, there's a point where spot on, the company is optimally staffed. That's what we have to reach. That's the key. That's the bee's knees. That's the wasp's nipples. The idea is that optimum number of people are needed to produce the company's revenue. Profit per employee is the highest at the optimum number of employees. Small businesses and very large companies operate under the diseconomies of scale by not having the optimum number of people. So they produce their products and services at higher than necessary costs. So first, every small and medium-sized enterprise has to get the economies of scale right. For the same reason, I always hire people as the very, very, very last resort, unless some totally amazing talent walks in. That's when I recommend clients, you know what, take this person. Of course, clients rebel. Yeah, but we don't have vacancies. Screw your vacancy. Take this as a precaution, because if this person walks into your competition, then your competition will kick your ass and push you out of the market. So take it as a preventive measure, because this person is talented, this person is valuable, and you want this person in your building, not in your competitor's building. Telling these unique people that the company is not hiring is just retarded, because, as I said, they just go to the competition. Now, we have to look at marketing percentages. Let's look at the percentages of how to split up the marketing budget. This is an investment split I've seen work effectively and like using it with my clients too. So invest 20% to generate new sales leads, 20% to nurture the leads into first-time clients, invest 40% to convert first-time clients into repeat clients, and stash away 20% for emergency. So let's go with the first 20% to generate leads. Yes, generate leads, but how? There are so many ways to do that. Some are expensive, some are cheap. You know what? Never mind the cost for now, but let's look at the potential return. In the written version, there's a little table, but you can follow it in the podcast too. So let's look at lead generation in a diagram. We have two dimensions, investment versus return. Let's look at high investment, low return lead generation methods. I think cold calling, trade shows, institutional image advertising, yellow pages, unless you have emergency services, full color brochures, and direct mail. If your receptionist writes the sales letters, you can waste an awful lot of money on direct mail stamp and postage and all that. But if the letter inside the envelope is crap because someone, one of your techies or the receptionist, writes the letter, not a proper copywriter, then you can waste an awful lot of money. Then we have low investment, low return lead generation tactics. Most networking functions, beggars banquets. Banner ads, cheap and cheesy threefold flyers, social media. If all you have is $10 an hour school kid to do the writing. So there are some stipulation here. Then we have high investment, high return lead generation tactics, direct mail. Whatever we do, direct mail is pricey because we are talking about envelopes and paper and stamps and all that has to be delivered. PR is free, basically, but the preparation is expensive because you need to hire someone who understands how PR operates, and you need someone who understands the overall dynamics of PR and can help you to prepare all the necessary documents you need for the journalists. Live seminars, extremely effective, but they cost money to organize. Systematic relationship building. This is various follow-up processes and follow-up with value. And that value has to be created. Deepening current client relationships. So, again, all that costs money. It can include breakfast meetings, briefings with clients, and direct response offline advertising can be advertising trade journals or the kind of trade journals your target market reads. And then we have low investment, high return methods, email autoresponders, writing and publishing meaty content, speaking engagements, all forms of content generation and distribution, webcasts, teleconferences, search engine optimization, pay-per-click, and social media, provided you have a pro writer. And if you have a writer who also has a reasonable understanding of marketing, search engine optimization, and copywriting, then you are very lucky. But in my experience, most of these people are freelancers and are pretty expensive. And now when I say low investment, high return, so low investment tactics are not necessarily cheap. I use low investment because relative to the return, the investment is really, really low. Now we know that both costs and returns are relative, so either we choose low cost or high return, and we use, according to that choice we make, we use different approaches. Content is so important that having access to a great writer can make or break your marketing. By writer, I mean both a copywriter and the general content writer. Both are expensive, so when you hire one the first time around, you may get a crying fit. But this is how you get great return. Hiring an army of 10 bucks an hour kids to do cold calling or to write articles, 5 bucks article, which then you put on Easing Articles or similar places, is retarded. High-level buyers don't read that kind of stuff. Also, 10 bucks an hour school kids for cold calling. There's a problem. There is no peer-level match. A 10 bucks an hour school kid is not a peer with a CEO of a $100 million company. They don't speak the same language. They have nothing to talk about. And an executive is not going to take a school kid seriously. So let's forget about this lunacy of hiring $10 an hour people to call upon executives. It's not going to achieve much. It only takes the name of your company out that you're a fungible hunter. But the whole idea of marketing is to position your company as a respected and recognized expert, not as a fungible vendor, a dreaded peddler, a bizarre huckster, but a respected expert. Ideally, we want to operate in the midway point of this diagram, somewhere between low investment, high return and high investment, high return areas. So we make a reasonable investment and get great return. And as we keep tweaking our approaches, we get better and better return. And then the question is not how to reduce our costs, but the question becomes, how can I invest even more into this marketing tactic and get better results? So, basically to a point, until the point of diminishing returns, you can just increase your investment in that marketing tactic, and that will give you increased return. One more point here. Use only those marketing methods that you would be comfortable with to receive as a buyer. So if you hate receiving cold calls, then don't do it to others. If you hate reading long sales letters with slimy red headlines and full of emotional hot button pounding, then don't send out those kind of sales letters to your market. For instance, I hate when people use manipulative sales techniques on me, so I don't use them on my prospects. Yes, at traditional standards, I suck at selling, but as long as my marketing brings me self-qualified prospects who are ready to buy from me, I never have to sell in a traditional sense for the rest of my life. A while ago, I found a poem on the web by Cy Diffin entitled The Slaughterman's Creed. I'm not sure if it is a poem, but let's call it a poem for now. It's vital for me because I frequently slaughter on my joint venture farms, so I hold myself to that in marketing as well. So the poem is, thine is the task of blood. Discharge thy task with mercy. Let thy victim feel no pain. Let sudden blow bring death, such death as thou thyself would ask for. And as long as I'm willing to die the way I slaughter my animals, I'm comfortable with the process. So, and this goes back to this whole marketing thing, that what methods am I comfortable to receive? So I use the same method to prospects to my market, because that brings me like-minded people. So that will bring me my ideal clients. And that's important. We haven't talked about it, but you just have to have your ideal client profile set up. Now, 20%, you invest 20% to nurture the sales leads to first-time clients. In complex sales, we generate sales-ready leads in one step or two steps. In the one-step process, you generate leads and nurture them to the point of conversion by offering them valuable content to establish your company as respected and recognized experts. It takes some time, but it's still a lot better than trying to sell something as a fungible vendor, or as they are called, bloody peddlers. So invest 20% of your budget to generate new sales leads and focus on the two-step process. Yes, sales can be generated in one step, but in my experience, to reach the cream of the crop of the target market, the truly value-driven clients need two steps. The one-step process usually leads to false opportunities, like allowing your company to respond to an RFP. And then you're bleeding to death in a bidding war. This is a miserable way of doing business. So, well, let's just skip it and forget about this retarded one-step process. And 20% is set aside for emergency reserve. This is the bit that is often missed. While your marketing is constantly tested, so results improve day after day, and major surprises may not happen for a long time, but once in a while, some major shit may hit the fan pretty badly and stink up your company beyond human imagination. While your marketing is constantly tested, so results improve day after day, and major surprises may not happen for a long time, but once in a while, some major shit can hit the fan pretty badly and stink up your company so badly that it smells like a whorehouse at low tide. Imagine you're running some large-scale Google AdWords campaigns, and one day Google pulls the rug from under your feet. Your ads are gone and Google has banned you for some reason. Now what? You have to regroup, design and execute another program that fulfills the same purpose that your Google ads were doing. This is the time when you need your 20%. This is the time when that money comes handy. And now for the marketing budget itself. This is more of an art than a science. There are no rigid numbers here. But remember Peter Drucker's words again. There will always, one can assume, be need for some selling, but the aim of marketing to make selling superfluous. The aim of marketing is to know and understand the customer so well that the product and service fits him and sells itself. Now, you may have seen ads, I certainly have, or had prospects who told me, hey, we want to hire you, our product is so good, it sells itself. Yes, it can do that, if it has a good marketing program behind it, a marketing engine. But nothing can be sold without marketing. So if you create a marketing-driven organization as opposed to a production or sales-driven organization, you can have the cream of the crop of the target market come to you, ready to do business with you at your fees and prices and on your terms. Yes, sales and production can produce high gross sales, but the profit per employee is questionable. Marketing creates the profit. Marketing creates the margin. Sales creates the volume. Deciding about the marketing budget is like for a farmer to decide how much seed corn he needs to achieve his desired yield. It's not about buying a new tractor or more powerful truck, but about buying more seed corn. Or maybe not even more seed corn, but if possible, less but better seed corn. We humans try to achieve more by doing more of the same. If you advertise in 5 magazines, that results in X sales. The goal to achieve 2X is not by advertising in 10 magazines. Let's try to achieve 2X by improving the 5 ads, tracking where the results are coming from, and ditch the low-performing magazines. Your cost keeps going down while your results are getting better and better. One important point is that you always use your projected revenue as the basis of your marketing budget. Let's say your company made $50 million in 2009 and now projects to go to $65 million in 2010. Then you establish your marketing budget as the percentage of the projected $65 million, not the old number of $50 million. But the key is not really the percentage itself, but that you track your marketing results, and as your results improve, your confidence to increase your budget will go up. And your confidence will go up because you know you can expect better results. and don't let your accountant to convince you to shrink your marketing budget to reduce operating costs. That's bullshit, really. What's the logic in reducing costs by X if it also means to forego 3, 5, 10X of revenue? So constantly improve the performance of your marketing tactics, and if you can quadruple your return by doubling your investment, then go for it. And if your accountant tries to talk you out of it, then you may consider firing him. On summary, buyers don't want to buy solutions on silver platters. They want to participate in the diagnosis of the problem and the development of the solution. Clients are willing to change suppliers even when a new supplier is exactly the same as the current supplier. Clients are naturally itching to change just for the sake of change. Buyers buying experiences trump sales tricks and techniques. You can hire more aggressive salespeople to push your stuff onto the market, but all you achieve is that the market gets pissed off with your company and your carefully built brand quickly turns into shit. The key is to pull self-qualified buyers to you like a magnet. Buyers buy ideas before they buy your services. Respected and recognized experts start buyer relationships by sharing valuable ideas. Only fungible vendors, street peddlers, and bazaar hucksters try to sell in the first step. That's why most vendors end up with the kind of buyers who are willing to buy after the first contact. The chicken and the egg dilemma is up for debate as to which came first, but in the ROI equation, the investment must come first. The farmer can't just go out to the field and scream at the soil, "Give me crops and next year I'll consider planting." All the worms in the soil would laugh their asses off at the dumb farmer. I used to be a farmer on a small scale and tried everything to skip the hard work, but it didn't do the trick. Using sweet talking or harsh language didn't compel the soil to give me harvest. So, the lesson here is that if you truly believe in your solutions, then make a decent investment and trumpet your magic message in all directions to bring down the resistance. And on this note, let's end this month's trumpeting. And we talk, if I live that long, we talk in April when again we discuss some interesting topic. So in the meantime, have a great week, have a great month, and we talk a bit later.